This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
It's been almost 3 years since Alec Murdaugh was found guilty of murdering his wife and son. I know, hard to believe, a verdict that seemed too close, seemed to close the book on the Southern dynasty built on power and deceit. But it didn't end there. Now, three final filings sit before the South Carolina Supreme Court, and they tell two very different stories about justice. The state says this is simple. The evidence was overwhelming. The kennel video put him there. His lies sealed it. Case closed. Go away. Make another miniseries. The defense says the opposite, that their trial itself was tainted before it ever began, that the clerk of court, Becky Hill, influenced jurors, the key DNA went untested, experts were pressured, and the process itself collapsed under the weight of misconduct. So the question now isn't whether Alec Murdaugh is guilty, it's whether the system that convicted him still deserves our trust. And depending on that decision, that's what could lead us to a courtroom where the arguments of the actual case could be brought up again. Right now, the argument is about the system itself, not the actual act of murder. Joining us is former prosecutor and defense attorney Eric Faddis to break down what this appeal really means legally, ethically, and for every person who still believes the courts should get it right, even when the whole world already has picked a side. Eric, welcome. In a case like this that lands in front of a state Supreme Court, what are the justices weighing here? The facts or the integrity of how those facts were handled?
Well, like you alluded to, Tony, the Supreme Court has a big responsibility ahead of it because it needs to look at, of course, the significance of the case itself, the facts of the case itself. But also there are larger concerns. There are larger concerns about the system. And you know, sometimes even when we have an unpopular defendant, what safeguards must be honored and observed such that we can have that systemic integrity, even when we think the jury might have got it right? Was there some sort of error that could impugn the system and diminish our reliance on it going forward, and have the justices sort of balance all of those things?
And there's a lot of angles, and there's you know, three key places that the defense of Alec Murdaugh is going at here. We're going to get into all of those shortly. You know, from a dual perspective here, you have the prosecutor, then you have a defense, and on both ends. What's your first instinct in reading these filings that we have here? Confidence in the verdict or concern about the mechanics of all of this?
Right. I mean, there's truly a tension between confidence in the verdict and confidence in our system. And with this appeal, can we have both? Is that something that can be analyzed and with which the public can have faith going forward? And that's really at the crux of it. You know, I've reviewed the pleadings, and for what it's worth, I think Murdaugh makes a compelling argument. Certainly there are countervailing considerations on the other side. But yeah, it's really that tension between systemic issues and the facts of this horrific double homicide.
Eric, what kind of a challenge is there when your client is also an attorney? Are there challenges that come up, especially in something like this? Is it nice to have that second brain on file for you, or is that a hindrance at times?
You know, yes and no, Stacey, that can be a blessing and a curse. You know, they have legal insights sometimes that they see avenues that might not have been apparent to the attorney themselves, because they're the client. They know what happened. On the other side, sometimes they can become a little overbearing. They can sometimes influence legal decisions from their own sort of biased perspective, whereas a more objective attorney representing the lawyer might say, hey, look, you know, from an outsider's perspective, you shouldn't do that, bro. And I think that could have come up in Murdaugh's decision to testify in this case. So it can be difficult when you have a lawyer as a client and you want to provide strategic guidance and they want to provide strategic guidance. And
have sometimes you ever that had guidance one?
Conflict.
Have you ever had it? Yeah. How do you manage that? I mean, do you take them aside and go, enough, dude?
You know, there's an old saying, I think it's attributed to Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, and it's something to the effect of, you know, a person who represents themselves has a fool for a client. And really the principle is that you're not unbiased. If you're a party to the case, you have different prejudices and sympathies and leanings. And the attorney's job representing you is to sort of disabuse you of those and say, this is the objective legal analysis as I see it. And those two perspectives can really come into conflict.
Have we ever seen a case where, I mean, we've seen obviously people self-represent themselves, but it's usually people who are not attorneys. You would think you would see more in the line of people who actually are attorneys, or maybe you wouldn't because they have enough sense to know that's a horrible idea, even if you're extremely educated on the topic at hand.
Oh, totally. Yeah. The clients who are attorneys, often they know, you know, for me, for example, if I was going through some legal dispute that was outside of my practice area, you better believe I'm enlisting somebody who's a specialist in that. I don't know how to do probate law or whatever. Sure. And, you know, as the client themselves can become so emotionally invested in, you know, a particular fact of the case, like, hey, I don't believe I was doing anything wrong, right? I was doing something to help somebody out. And perhaps that's not material legally, but it's hard to detach them from some of those positions to which they're married, which could be to their legal detriment.
How much do you think Alex steered this case when we look back on it, or the courtroom and his attorneys? When we look back on it, you know, obviously it's all, you know, hindsight now, it's all history, seeing, you know, how the testimony went, who testified when, who said what. How do you think that went? Do you think that was more, you know, Jim and Dick that were running the show, or was Alec just as involved, if not more heavily involved in being a third captain of the ship, if you will?
I have to imagine that Alec tried to exert significant control over how his defense was presented and how they handled the case from that side. You know, like I said, his decision to testify, although there were arguably compelling reasons for him to do that, there are also a number of pitfalls, and I think he's stepped at a number of times. And so you got to wonder, hey, did his attorneys tell him, not sure you should testify here? And did he sort of overbear their decision by saying, hey, I'm a lawyer too. I know what I'm getting into. You know, shut up and let me handle this. I don't know that that's how it went, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were such interactions.
I'm curious to get your thoughts on this. We probably talked about it a year or two ago, but just to refresh, you know, my memory and everybody's memory, now that we're all kind of into this case again and the new special is out and all that, when Alec went to the stand and took the stand for himself in his snot-ridden testimony,
oh, God.
That was something.
It was so triggering.
It was something. When we look back on this, and he changed his story on the stand at that moment in time. For those playing along at home, he had denied being at the kennels forever, all the way up into that point, all the way through trial. Like, they had been arguing on his behalf that he was not at the kennels. Then suddenly, when Alec decides to go up and testify, boom, he drops a bombshell on everybody and says, I lied. I was at the kennels. Didn't say he killed anybody, but he lied. And then once he started telling that lie, oh, what a web we weave, or something he said. And it was, well, I started lying, so I had to keep lying. Obviously, the man is a pathological liar. Do you think that was part of the strategy all along? Or do you think that was a conversation the night before with Jim and Dick going, I think tomorrow I'm going to testify and I'm going to completely change my story publicly?
Oh, I think absolutely that the defense team had met pretrial about the possibility that Murdoch might want to testify, that he might have to testify just based on how the trial was going. So certainly those discussions were had. But yeah, there's a lot of recalibration as the trial's going on. And you know, like you said, in that 11th hour, the night before, you're having those discussion with the client and you're saying, hey, what's this going to look like? What risk do we need to try and control for? And that was something they couldn't deny, that he was there, because there is that video evidence that contradicts the statements he made to police and everybody else for months and months.
Yeah, I mean, and at that moment in time, how do you think his attorneys advised him at that moment? Do you think they said, go ahead, go up there, change your story? You've already been proven to be a liar about everything else. You're adding now a lie to the murder case. You're adding a lie about the very key moment where you should or should not be. And you're now going to go and expose this. Do you think they encouraged him to do that? Or was that an Alec move of he's just going to go and do what he's going to do?
I can't help but wonder if there was perhaps some overconfidence on both sides, on behalf of the defense attorneys and on behalf of Alec, to say, hey, look, this isn't just some layperson, you know, accountant or bartender or something who's going to get up there and talk. This is a seasoned attorney who could probably tailor his testimony in a compelling way. And even though there is this glaring issue of that makes it look like he's a huge liar, him being at the vicinity when this happened, I think maybe both sides thought he would be able to sort of sidestep and tiptoe around it and do a song and dance up there. And I think he was singing a little too much, dancing a little too much. And the jury was certainly rubbed the wrong way and by a lot of his testimony.
And we're going to get into some of this stuff here with the appeal, but I wanted to keep it on the trial itself and just kind of rehashing of some of that for a few moments. When we look back on other aspects of this case, on his personality, and we've seen so many cases where people act certain ways after a crime is committed. Sometimes, you know, there's a certain level of guilt that seems to emanate off of them. Sometimes there's a level of coldness that is there. And then sometimes it's hard to tell what's going on. When you look at him from a human perspective and the grief that he did appear to have all the way back from the kennel video to pretty much anybody interacting with him for the days and weeks after Maggie and Paul were shot, to him in the courtroom and his testimony, take the verdict out of it, take everything you know out of it. How, if you didn't know the case and the story, does he read like someone who's lying, that is lying about being involved in the murder of his family? Or does he read like someone who is grieving the death and he doesn't really know what's going on? Or maybe he does, but he's not the one who pulled the trigger.
You know, he certainly reads like a chameleon, like someone who knows how to keep up public appearances, who's savvy, who's sophisticated, who can present in a compelling way. He probably had to do that as an attorney for years, mm-hmm. and that's one of the reasons he was so successful. But on the inside, it seems like there was some serious, tumultuous stuff going on. There was the drug addiction. There was his financial ruin, which was happening, which it appears he was kind of in denial about that for years. And so it's just a conflict between what we're seeing on the outside and all of the chaos that likely was going on the inside. And so when a person has those sort of dual components, it's hard to tell whether they're being straight. Sometimes it's hard for them to tell whether they're being straight.
Yeah, I still struggle with that with him, you know, on the emotional end of it when I look at it, because I don't know. At the end of the day, I don't know. Is he a horrible guy? Did he do horrible things financially? Without a doubt. Was he able to lie straight face to, you know, people who are disabled, you know, people who lost their loved ones and steal their money? Yeah, that takes quite a monster to be able to do those sort of things. But at the end of the day, it was for insulating and maintaining his family. Then the idea that he's going to take them out, that's where we get to the familial side. And that's obviously what Creighton Waters argued in court, was that he took out his family basically because he didn't want to face their wrath or the shame that came along with basically Alec's mask falling and everyone seeing him for who he is, a thief, a crook, a liar. Everything that he pretended that he was against was actually who he actually was. And then did he take out his family to alleviate himself of that shame and to then create a distraction from all of that hoopla that was about to erupt? But at the end, I just don't know. Go ahead, Stacey.
Tony, couldn't you also say that maybe in some twisted, sick way, he wanted to spare them.
Yeah, I mean, you do see that. You see that with narcissists, where they're going to twist it. I mean, I've seen it where, okay, well, I will remove myself from this person's life if that's what's best for them, and they play the martyr. I mean, oftentimes it's not murder, but it's abandonment that you'll see that'll take place, and they'll spin it in a way that somehow, in their mind, looks like it's some sort of grace they're giving the world, when it's really just, it's more convenient for them because they don't want to deal with it. I mean, there's a lot of ways that it could be twisted around, and I can see it from both perspectives, but damn, he's a good chameleon. I mean, there's some bad liars out there, and his testimony was filled with a lot of snot, but it was hard to tell sometimes if there might have been tears going on there. I don't know. I mean, where do you sit on it, Eric? Like, where does your gut tell you? Where are you personally feeling about Alec Murdaugh these days on whether or not he did pull the trigger on this or had some involvement or none at all?
You know, I'm no Alec Murdaugh apologist, and I'm not a huge sympathizer of him as a person, but I've always had questions about this case. You mentioned the motive, and Alec Murdaugh's team brings that up in their appeal, actually. They say, hey, this motive is totally implausible. It doesn't really make sense. He had all these financial issues going on, so he kills his wife and kid who had nothing to do with it. How does, you know, that doesn't necessarily solve the financial issues. It doesn't, there's kind of a logical disconnect between, oh, you know, my bank accounts suck, therefore I'm going to shoot my wife and kid. Like, that didn't check out to me personally.
What shame.
I was skeptical of that.
Yeah, I mean, I can see it, though. It's about shame. I mean, that's shame, and mixed with a narcissistic personality and a disorder. And then you also put the opioids in there. And the opioids are what kind of make me go, maybe that's what pulled him over. Like, take the opioids out of the equation, and I don't know that I would think that he's the one who did it. But when you add that in, and just there doesn't seem to be a logical other suspect here at all. I mean, we've never, and that's another thing, we've never even heard of any other suspect. We've never even heard a story of, other than like, well, people were mad at them because of the boat crash. Yes, of course they were. I'm surprised, you know, that nothing else had happened. But oftentimes those things settle and people, you know, get on with their lives, and there's going to be that anger there forever. But for all these years after the boat crash, because it wasn't immediate, this was several years after that boat crash, that this takes place. But again, no other alternative suspects or even ideas on who it would be. And none even presented by Alec either, which I also found interesting in the trial. Sometimes you're going to get, you know, and obviously it's allowed, it's going to depend what they're allowed to introduce or not in terms of a third party suspect. But there was like not even an inkling of it off the record, off of the courts, from the attorneys when they're trying to play, you know, media games and give their spin. Were you surprised by that at all?
Totally. I mean, somebody did this. It was a person. And if it wasn't Alec Murdaugh, you know, you would think that he would have at least a sense as to what directions we can start looking at in terms of specific people. And in terms of the admissibility of alternative suspect defenses, usually you need to have a direct, non-speculative connection to an alternative suspect, an actual person. You can't just go in there and be like, could have been a lot of people, some people didn't like them or whatever. Usually you need to be like, hey, it could have been this person for these reasons. This was the connection. He was in the state at the time. He had this motive. He had the opportunity. He owned firearms, whatever. You have to get to that next level in terms of alternative suspect. They never got there.
They never even attempt to get there.
No.
And is, I mean, like, we've seen cases where they're really, really reaching for shit. Like, you know, there's some crazy cases that we've seen in the last year, and I won't go into them all because I'll piss people off, but where it's like, that's quite a reach. But it's amazing what can sometimes be admitted. If you were Alec's attorneys, would you be looking for something, anything? Or do you think maybe that they did? These aren't moronic attorneys. They're good attorneys. Yeah. They have track records. They are well-respected. It's not Jackie Fulford, the Tom Petty lookalike that's working out of the crematorium. So I'm going to guess they had to maybe explore that option. But if you have nowhere to go, I guess you have nowhere to go.
Without question, they explored it. And even Harpootlian, one of his defense attorneys, I believe, is a state senator out in South Carolina. So these are high profile premier attorneys. Yeah. I wonder what dead ends they may have hit and that precluded them from sort of launching a more compelling alternative suspect defense. Because I think the jury was like, as a human being did this, and mm-hmm. the person on trial, there's video of him being in the vicinity, you know, minutes before this likely happened. If it wasn't him, give us something, show it, give us something to hang our hats on. And there was no such rung provided by defense.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, sometimes if you're not going to want to try and present something out there if you know that a very big hole can be punched into it, and that might just be it. They knew that there was going to be holes punched into anything that they were going to come up with. Before we move into talking more about the motion here and the arguments, the Becky Hill, the sled issues, all of that, Stacey, in the comments, is there anything on this area of the case where we're talking about the crime itself, Alec Murdaugh, and this half? That's of note.
Yeah, really good comment from the last 24. It says, I'm real interested in them recently opening back up the Stephen Smith case. They thought his son could have been linked to, in my opinion, if he was Alec Knows and or had a hand in the cover-up. So that link coming out in our comment section. Yeah. A lot of comments about the snot.
Yeah. And the Stephen Smith case is a fascinating one. I personally do not think Buster had anything to do with it. I feel horrible for that kid. I think he's a victim to the circumstances of that family. There just never has been any sort of evidence that seemed to have come to light that makes any sense of it. Was there knowledge of, you know, in the good old boy club of who maybe, you know, would have had it out likely for a gay teen in that area of the country at that moment in time? I would think maybe. I would think there might be some rumblings and inklings about it. But, you know, because there's, you know, hatred runs deep in those parts on issues like that. And, you know, could there be knowledge? Maybe. But I don't know. I don't see a connection with Buster on that. And I feel bad for all the shit that he's had to go through as a victim of his family. But that is that's a very compelling case. It still sits with zero answers on it as well. Where do you think that could be headed in the future, Eric?
You know, I think that if there was enough there to raise a material issue in Murdaugh's trial itself, that it would have been used as a ground for appeal. I reviewed the pleadings. I didn't personally see that in there. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of reminds me of the Koberger case where he was sort of angling towards, hey, someone else could have done this. Okay, well, who? And his defense couldn't find and identify an actual mm-hmm. alternative suspect. And I think that that sort of played out here where there was just not enough evidence to tie that thing as horrible as it was to the Murdaugh case itself. And without it being included in the appeal, I think it's going to be dead in the water at this point.
Yeah. And that's unfortunate because that family wants answers and, you know, anybody wants answers on that
one. Well, they deserve answers. I mean, that's the bigger thing.
Yeah. I wonder if we're ever going to get them or if it's one of those that's, you know, people are so tight-lipped on some of those things there that we're never going to get it. And the easiest thing to do when you don't know the answer is to fill in the blanks with who likely could be have something to do with this. Well, this family's up to no good in a lot of things, so maybe it's them. And then that's how you get, you know, the cascade of everything. I thought it was interesting how they portrayed it in the in the new series. Let's talk about Becky Hill as we continue to talk with Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, about the Alec Murdaugh case. And we're getting a step closer to possibly getting a retrial. We're in the process right now of, okay, it's going to the Supreme Court, and they have to make some decisions, whether they're going to hear oral arguments or not, or if it's dead on arrival. We're now waiting for that. Let's talk about Becky Hill, one of the big reasons for all this, the clerk who handled the jury, helped coordinate logistics, and later wrote a book about the case that was pulled because she plagiarized some of it. One juror swore Hill told them to watch Alec's body language and don't be fooled. The defense says that alone destroyed the verdict. The state calls it a passing comment that changed nothing legally and practically. How big of a problem is that, Eric?
Jeez.
You know, that's the question with which the Supreme Court is going to wrestle, because, you know, one, was it a problem in the trial? It appears from the hearing on it and everything else, the transcript, that it was a problem, that she did engage in some kind of misconduct. So the next question is, how big of a problem in the trial was it? Was it what's called harmless error, meaning that he would have been convicted even absent that happening? That's what the prosecution is saying. Whereas defense is saying, no, not only is it not harmless, it's in fact what's called structural error. What defense is saying is that this was such an egregious violation of Alec Murdaugh's rights that it poisoned the entire trial. The outcome cannot be relied upon. We got to have a do-over. That's what defense is saying.
That was a gutsy thing for her to do. I mean, what would provoke her to think that she could get away with something like this? Do you think she's probably done this before and gotten away with it? Or just, I'm going to step out and do this to influence this trial? Or do you think this was just how it's done there?
You know, what we're talking about is the low country out there in South Carolina. And like Tony said earlier, there's sort of a good old boys mentality. And in some rural jurisdictions I've seen where folks are a little too close in terms of the court system and how they're interacting with jurors and their preconceived notions. And sometimes in smaller jurisdictions, it's a comment and nothing really comes of it. But due to the magnifying glass that was on this trial, I think her stepping out of line there came to the forefront when it might not have in the past. And, you know, is this the first time she's ever talked to jurors about a trial while the trial's going on? The first time she's ever done that in her life and she happened to get popped for it? Seems unlikely.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it gutsy or just ignorant? I mean, because sometimes gutsy, I think, can be confused with ignorance. You know, there's people that'll say stupid shit all the time. And then you're like, some people are like, oh, wow, they're saying that. That's gutsy if you don't know what they are. And then it, like, you look at their track record and it's like, that's not gutsy. They just don't know when to shut the F up. To me, that kind of feels like this. But regardless of what's going on in the back of her mind, what's running this machine, that doesn't matter. What matters is what came out of her mouth and then how it affected a juror or jurors or did not. The state's argument is basically, even if she said it, the evidence was strong enough to outweigh it. That's a dangerous precedent to set. It's basically saying that if the evidence is strong enough in any case, our clerk of court can pretty much say anything they want to you, and the evidence will stand on its own. You don't have to. She's not going to weigh on you. Why? Because we're saying she's not going to weigh on you. That's not how this works.
No, you can't unhear it.
You make such an important point, and in fact, that similar point is echoed in the defense's appellate brief, where they say, hey, look, prosecution wants you to just ignore this and say, hey, it was no big deal. But if we did that, we'd have a system, you know, that'd be the same as saying, hey, what if Becky just paid this juror to vote guilty? You know, what if she engaged in some further misconduct? If the rationale is that, oh, well, there was a ton of evidence, so who cares? That undermines, you know, the sort of fundamental structure of the entire system and the reliability that the public places in it.
What I'm troubled by is where it's sitting, because we did learn in the last round of hearings where Gene Toll basically, you know, punted it down the line a little bit, literally got on football clothing, a uniform, and she went out there, put Alec Murdaugh's face on a football and punted it outside of the Colleton County Courthouse. It was quite a scene, and she made the field goal. It was quite a neat. But in all seriousness, she punted it down the line, and she punted it down the line, and basically saying, you know, I don't find that there's, you know, anything that went wrong here, even though we had a juror that flat out said, no, she said this, and it affected me. How is it where the judge or the system can be the person that decides what is truly affecting someone or not, when the very person that they're asking, did this affect you or not, says, yes, this affected me. And they can go back and say, nah, it didn't. Right. Then why'd you ask?
I've contended from the very beginning that the judge got it wrong on the motion for a new trial. And, you know, in the appellate brief for defense, they cite to the transcript where they're asking this juror about this statement. The juror confirms that the statement was made, that, you know, don't be fooled by the defendant who was exercising his constitutional right to testify. And then they ask the juror, hey, point blank, did this affect your verdict? Did this influence you to vote guilty? And according to the transcript in the brief, the juror said yes. And so, for a judge to sort of second guess, what are they contending, that the juror was lying under oath about this thing that is probably very, you know, chaotic and traumatic for them, they didn't ask to be involved in. It seems like the judge was sort of substituting their own feelings about the case and didn't want to be the ones responsible for overturning such a high profile murder conviction. Sure. When he punted down the line to the higher ups.
It feels like gaslighting. Like, no, you didn't. Yeah. You weren't affected by that. Don't look behind the curtain.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, well, why are you even having a hearing on this then?
Yeah.
If you're going to have a hearing on it, you kind of have to accept the answers to what they are. Reality on reality's terms. If the juror is saying, yes, this affected me, well, then you got your answer. Just because it doesn't go along with a narrative that you'd like it to be, the clear cut, no, none of this affected me. Okay, great. Clear cut. We wouldn't be talking about this then. And be like, see, it didn't do anything. And they're all claiming it didn't do anything. But there are. They are claiming it did do something, and they're still like, nah, no, it didn't. We got it. It's just kind of stunning how that works.
Oh, it is. And you know, I think personally, just looking at this from a legalistic lens, I think Murdoch has a decent shot to get a new trial at the Supreme Court level based on this alleged clerk misconduct that affected the jury, and they testified it affected their verdict. That's really, that's essentially the legal standard defense has to meet. Seems like they met it.
But do you think there's going to be a different outcome, though? We're going to go through this all over again, and we're probably going to get the same outcome, don't you think?
Critical question, Stacey, and it reminds me of the Miranda case. So we all know the Miranda warnings, where you have to tell the suspect, hey, anything you say can be used against you, right, remain silent, that kind of thing. Because what happened in that case is there was a horrendous murder. The defendant Miranda was accused of it. He wasn't given his rights. He was convicted at trial. The trial was overturned. He got a new trial because of he wasn't read those rights. And at the new trial, he was convicted again and sentenced to decades in prison. So we may very well have the same outcome, but if we do so in a way that also bolsters the credibility and reliability of our and fairness of our system, maybe that's the right way to go.
That's why we're doing it.
Yeah, I mean, it's arguing for the procedure, not necessarily the merits of the case yet. There's a time and place, but it's getting to it. Hill's later criminal charges, believe it or not, she got charged with other things that had nothing to do with it, but certainly about perception. Do you think that's going to matter to the judges, that she's been charged with other crimes after the possible tampering with the jury? Is that something that they consider when they take a look at the character of the person, and, you know, what, when they're really trying to weigh what sort of volume she put onto that jury?
You know, it certainly is a bad look for Becky Hill, and you know, a judge is a human being. And so they're looking at this and they're saying, hey, did she make these statements? What was her tone? What was her inflection? What was her intention? And then you sort of look at the contextual stuff of, oh, she's also charged with these other kinds of wrongdoings. That could lead someone to sort of lean into the notion that she was a bad actor here and may have substantially contributed to some kind of miscarriage of justice, similar to stuff with which she's been criminally charged.
The defense is also claiming that it wasn't just a murder trial. It was a character trial. There was a week of financial testimony about theft and fraud that the defense is going to say had nothing to do with the murders themselves. The prosecution is going to say it absolutely did. It had a lot to do with the motive of why Alec did allegedly what he did and what he's been convicted of. Prosecutors insist it was a crucial motive and a crucial piece of evidence that the financial storm closing in explained why the murders even happened. Where's that line, though, between relevant motive and prejudicial overkill if we do see a Alec Murdaugh trial round two? The financial stuff has all been settled now. At the Murdaugh trial, I don't believe it had been quite yet. Is that something that do you think would get brought back up again? Certainly the prosecution would want it as part of their argument for motive. But does it get brought up again? I believe it was even brought up on accident the first time because somebody overspoke and suddenly it opened the door to even bringing all of that into the courtroom.
Totally. So there is a legal principle enshrined within a rule of evidence that essentially says, if there is evidence, and it might have some relevance, but it's substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice, then it shouldn't be admitted. Unfair prejudice can be like, oh, we're making this dude out to look like such a bad, like he has such a bad character, which could cause a jury to sort of say, hey, I don't know if they brought enough evidence on the homicide charge, but this guy's a bad dude. Let's let him have it. That's the concern the court wants to avoid. And I think that there was probably some transgressions of that line in the original trial. I think perhaps some evidence of a financial motive would have been appropriate, but prosecutors kind of came out guns a-blazing and spent a week on it. And that might have gone too far in terms of painting Murdaugh like a bad dude and running the risk that the jury would convict him on that basis instead of on the basis of the homicide evidence.
Is there some minimized version of the financial crimes that could be presented where it doesn't literally go into feeling like it's a trial for financial crimes, which is what the last murder trial did, where we're able to present it to a certain point, to a certain line, and certain outcomes may or may not be revealed? But because it is, if you're going to argue this was familiar side and here's the motive for it, the financial crimes have to be a part of it. Do you see a world where if we do see, you know, making a Murdaugh round two, that we're going to have a judge saying, no, this isn't part of it, or here's how much we would let in?
Absolutely. And that happens all the time, Tony, all the time in cases like this, in other types of cases, in child abuse cases, for example, where there may have been, you know, the defendant was accused of, I don't know, mistreating some other child in some other state and some other relationship, you know, years apart from their current accusation. If that comes into evidence, that can be unduly prejudicial. So judges usually kind of make a compromise and they'll say, hey, we'll permit a significant reference to it, but we're not going to go into all the details. And we're also going to limit the instances of alleged financial misconduct. You can talk about prosecution, you know, three or so, but you can't talk about 10 or 20. And I think that limitation was not strong enough in the original trial. And it's, in fact, a ground for appeal for Murdaugh to say that there was too much financial stuff let in. Yeah. If there is a new trial, I think it'll be substantially circumscribed, or at least the judge will be prudent in doing so.
Another big claim that they're putting up here in the grounds, one of the three to the Supreme Court that they're going to decide on, is the investigative claims, which, depending how you look at it, worked for Murdaugh's favor, maybe didn't work in Murdaugh's favor. It all kind of depends. Basically, bad police work, missing DNA tests, no fingerprint lifts. There were some very obvious things that were missed here in investigating a double homicide, where I don't know if it was the local authorities coming in thinking, oh, it's Alec Murdaugh. He couldn't have possibly done this. But in the, I don't even know why that would even come into the equation here. If you're trying to figure out who did do this, them trampling all over this active crime scene, not getting some of these tests done on pieces of evidence that are there. There was a lot that was mishandled. There was a lot that could have been certainly done better. In one way, if it was Alec, well, then right. They never gathered the evidence that pointed to it being Alec. But if it wasn't, they also never gathered the evidence that pointed to it not being Alec. So it kind of works in his favor both ways. If you're trying to figure out who did this, how strong of a grounds do you think they have in this case when it comes to those investigative issues?
You know, generally speaking, shoddy investigation is an argument you make to a jury, not a judge. And you're going to get much more traction with a jury than a judge on that because, you know, just saying like, hey, the police kind of sucked in this case. No appellate judge is going to be like, oh, yeah, the police did suck. I'll give you a new trial. That's not how it works.
Yeah.
However, if it does rise to the level of precluding the defense from being able to conduct their own forensic analysis, to put forth their own experts, that's when this sort of it's called spoliation or an inability for the defense to really avail themselves of possible helpful evidence. I'm not sure it rose to that level here. You know, I think the firearms could have been retested by defense and there could have been measures taken. I don't think it sort of stripped the defense of being able to argue or do their own DNA analysis or fingerprint analysis or stuff like that.
Well, and the fact here, at the end of the day, Alec Murdaugh is going to be away for the rest of his life in prison on the financial crimes charges, unless something magically changes there, which, you know, who the hell knows? But the odds are not great. He's likely going to be dying in prison, even if, for some reason, the verdict on the homicides are overturned or he gets a new trial and he's found not guilty. It seems that this is more of a matter of record, of legacy, of principle, of not going down before Alec eventually kicks it as being the murderer of his wife and son. That's a big thing. I mean, people wouldn't want to go down for that if you didn't actually do that. If they grant a new trial, critics are going to say technically they freed a murderer. Supporters are going to say that fairness finally won. How does the justice system kind of try and survive both narratives at once, depending on what happens?
You know, I think that it is incumbent upon the justice system to ensure that constitutional rights are observed and that there is a fairness in this process. Even when the defendant is unpopular, unlikable, appears very factually guilty, even under those circumstances, we need to protect these fundamental pillars of the system, because when we begin to allow corners to be cut and folks to be slighted as defendants just because we don't like it that much or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think we have a tremendous problem systemically. And on top of that, you know, there's crazier stuff has happened, man. We look at the Ghislaine Maxwell case. You know, she was dead to rights. She was convicted. Yeah. Right. And now she's already got a better situation in terms of a more lenient incarceration facility.
She gets puppies. Puppies. Yeah, right. She gets puppies. Right.
You know, yeah. And she's posturing towards some additional clemency, which people are saying is at least possible. And so might not be as grim as it might look for Alec Murdaugh. Stranger things have happened, man.
I think that's what he's betting on. I mean, is if he can get the murder conviction overturned, it's one less roadblock. It's one less large brick wall that he's going to have to try and jump over. Because, yes, stranger things have happened. That's the scary part. Stacey, what are we looking at in the comments for thoughts on this area?
So Spinster says, what about the fake unaliving attempt by Cousin Eddie on Alec? Seems like he was thinking unaliving would resolve his issues. So that's one comment.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about that. I mean, the unaliving, an interesting move. And what was the true goal all along there? Was it to do exactly what he did, where it was to look like an attempt, or was he truly wanting to kill himself. Cousin Eddie has said, his name Cousin is Cousin Eddie.
I'm sorry. I just chuckle every time you say that.
Well, is it, I don't believe it is. It's literally Cousin Eddie.
I know, yeah.
It literally is Cousin Eddie. His attorney on this show before. But I guess you kind of got to figure out who you're trying to believe there, because Cousin Eddie says, here's what happened. He wanted me to try and kill him, and it didn't work out well. And this is, you know, it was all an act. And Alec is, you know, saying a completely different story. That's another weird aspect to this case that I think a lot of people have forgotten about, that certainly would be important to a jury if this does go back. How do you think that plays under the optics of time?
You know, I think that it inures to the detriment of Alec Murdoch, because if that information goes to a jury, you know, what they might be thinking is, hey, look, Alec Murdoch was an attorney. He knows the system. He has a chance at trial, especially if he didn't do this. Why kill yourself? Why not? Go the distance and fight for your innocence and get to that point. Whereas someone who, if they were genuinely trying to kill themselves, that seems like they might have a consciousness of guilt. They might need this to end in that way rather than being in a box for the rest of their lives. I think it's overall is not a good look for Alec Murdoch.
It makes me wonder how much the drugs did play into it. The way it was portrayed, and again, this is the show. This is the Murdaugh murders, the series that's on Hulu right now. I thought it was interesting how they portrayed it, where it was kind of like a manic drug-induced or drug-fueled, you know, psychotic thought process, basically. I don't know if psychotic is the right word to use here, but certainly not a decision that a healthy Alec Murdoch might have made. And it just like maybe the murders, just like maybe many of these other things, the stealing of the money. I mean, how many of these decisions, you know, how many, at the end of the day, did Alec really just make absolutely horrible, completely barbaric self-interest decisions under the influence of these drugs that he was on? Doesn't excuse it, but is that the recipe of Alec Murdoch and why he unraveled in such spectacular tragedy over the last few years of his freedom?
You know, the drug piece of this, I think, cannot be understated. That is a epidemic in our country, mm-hmm. and the way that it can affect a person, I've seen it firsthand. Mm-hmm. It can completely change a person, and it changes their thought process, their perception. Mm-hmm. It changes their emotionality, their sense of paranoia at times, their decision making. It can affect all of these categories, and so you know, was that at play in some form or fashion in this case? I think it's undeniable that it was.
Well, yeah. I think, you know, watching him, he was so addicted that he was not in his right mind. Who knows if he had just this psychotic episode and thought that his family members were out to get him. I mean, we don't know what really went down in his brain. He just wasn't in his right mind. And now he's obviously clean of drugs. Maybe he doesn't even know what the hell he did.
I wonder that. I do wonder if Alec did it in a drug-induced state, has mm-hmm. no recollection of it, and truly believes he did not do it.
Yeah, he may not even think he did it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I don't get the vibe that this guy believes he did it. Doesn't mean he didn't do it.
Right.
But I think I get the vibe he believes he didn't do it. Kind of in a Lori Vallow sort of way of just complete divorce from reality of what's going on around you, but able to just kind of talk about reality like they're seeing it, like it's all there, even though those things you're claiming happened did not take place the way you are envisioning them.
Well, in his mind, he may think that an innocent man is behind bars because in his mind, he never did it.
Yeah.
He wasn't present when it happened. So he didn't do it.
I know. It's fascinating. We'll see where this goes. How long do you think it'll take here for the Supreme Court of South Carolina to make a ruling on these three things that are sitting in front of them?
You know, different jurisdictions have different timelines on this kind of thing. That being said, with all of the national attention, with all of the spotlight on the case, I think the Supreme Court has a motivation to decide on this promptly. I'm guessing a handful of months. I would think early 2026 is when we get to a place where we'll have some finality, at least at this level of the appeals.
Mm-hmm. And then it goes to oral arguments if they accept it, if they say, okay, let's hear it, and then they're going to have to argue. And then the court then would decide, is that like the next gateway after that? Is the next gateway a trial? If they hear the oral arguments and say, yes, this is valid, you deserve a new trial, or is there more hoops to jump through?
Right. So if after the oral arguments, the Supreme Court says, hey, Murdoch is entitled to a new trial, it would go back to the trial court. We'd start all over and we'd have another trial, which would be months and months down the road. If the court denies the appeal, there are still likely some appellate avenues to be explored, like a sort of a habeas corpus Hail Mary to a federal court and trying to get some relief on that end. But if the court denies this appeal, this could be the beginning of the end for Alex Murdoch.
Do you think this will have some resolution of some sort in the next year, or are we talking years from now, a new trial?
Yeah, no, I would say 2026 is a reasonable timetable for a new trial or a Supreme Court, a South Carolina Supreme Court denial.
Gotcha. So if they say in the next month or two, oral arguments, then we'll see that probably early next year. And then a trial maybe late next year, early 2020, what are we into? Next year's 27? I almost want to order the popcorn now.
You should.
It might be stale by the time it actually takes place. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, as always, thank you so much for coming on and giving us your insight into this case. It's very fascinating, as always.
Always happy to be with you.
All right. Let me know your thoughts in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Brewski. That's where you will find us. Do that same search wherever you get podcasts. And be sure to press subscribe. And like I said, give us your thoughts on YouTube. Until next time, for Stacey and Todd and Eric, I'm Tony Brewski. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.